instructions. When the city of Ember was just built and not yet inhabited, the chief builder and the assistant builder, both of them weary, sat down to speak of the future.
They must not leave the city for at least 200 years, said the chief builder, or perhaps 220.
Is that long enough? Asked his assistant.
It should be. We can't know for sure.
And when the time comes, said the assistant, how will they know what to do?
We'll provide them with instructions, of course, the chief builder replied.
But who will keep the instructions? Who can we trust to keep them safe and secret all that time?
The mayor of the city will keep the instructions, said the chief builder. We'll put them in a box with a timed lock, set to open on the proper date.
And will we tell the mayor what's in the box? The assistant asked.
No, just that it's information they won't need and must not see until the box opens of its own accord.
So, the first mayor will pass the box to the next mayor, and that one to the next, and so on down through the years, all of them keeping it secret all that time?
What else can we do? Asked the chief builder. Nothing about this endeavor is certain. There may be no one left in the city by then, or no safe place for them to come back to.
So the first mayor of Ember was given the box, told to guard it carefully, and solemnly sworn to secrecy. When she grew old, and her time as mayor was up, she explained about the box to her successor, who also kept the secret carefully, as did the next mayor. Things went as planned for many years, but the seventh mayor of Ember was less honorable than the ones who'd come before him, and more desperate. He was ill. He had the coughing sickness that was common in the city then, and he thought the box might hold a secret that would save his life. He took it from its hiding place in the basement of the gathering hall and brought it home with him, where he attacked it with a hammer. But his strength was failing by then. All he managed to do was dent the lid a little, and before he could return the box to its official hiding place or tell his successor about it, he died. The box ended up at the back of a closet, shoved behind some old bags and bundles. There it sat, unnoticed, year after year, until its time arrived, and the lock quietly clicked open. Chapter 1. Assignment Day. In the city of Ember, the sky was always dark. The only light came from great flood lamps mounted on the buildings and at the tops of poles in the middle of the larger squares. When the lights were on, they cast a yellowish glow over the streets. People walking by threw long shadows that shortened and then stretched out again. When the lights were off, as they were between 9 at night and 6 in the morning, the city was so dark that people might as well have been wearing blindfolds. Sometimes, darkness fell in the middle of the day. The city of Ember was old, and everything in it, including the power lines, was in need of repair. So now and then, the lights would flicker and go out. These were terrible moments for the people of Ember. As they came to a halt in the middle of the street, or stood stock still in their houses, afraid to move in the utter blackness, they were reminded of something they preferred not to think about. That someday, the lights of the city might go out and never come back on. But most of the time, life proceeded as it always had. Grown people did their work, and younger people, until they reached the age of 12, went to school. On the last day of their final year, which was called Assignment Day, they were given jobs to do. The graduating students occupied room 8 of the Ember School. On assignment day of the year 241, this classroom, usually noisy first thing in the morning, was completely silent. All 24 students sat upright and still at the desks they'd grown too big for. They were waiting. The desks were arranged in 4 rows of 6, one behind the other. In the last row sat a slender girl named Lina Mayfleet. She was winding a strand of her long, dark hair around her finger, winding and unwinding it again and again. Sometimes she plucked at a thread on her ragged cape or bent over to pull on her socks, which were loose and tended to slide down around her ankles. One of her feet tapped the floor softly. In the second row was a boy named Dune Harrow. He sat with his shoulders hunched, his eyes squeezed shut in concentration, and his hands clasped tightly together. His hair looked rumpled, as if he hadn't combed it for a while. He had dark, thick eyebrows, which made him look serious at the best of times, and when he was anxious or angry, came together to form a straight line across his forehead. His brown corduroy jacket was so old that its ridges had flattened out. Both the girl and the boy were making urgent wishes. Dune's wish was very specific. He repeated it over and over again, his lips moving slightly, as if he could make it come true by saying it 1,000 times. Lina was making her wish in pictures rather than in words. In her mind's eye, she saw herself running through the streets of the city in a red jacket. She made this picture as bright and real as she could. Lina looked up and gazed around the schoolroom. She said a silent goodbye to everything that had been familiar for so long. Goodbye to the map of the City of Ember in its scarred wooden frame, and the cabinet whose shelves held the Book of Numbers, the Book of Letters, and the Book of the City of Ember. Goodbye to the cabinet drawers labeled New Paper and Old Paper. Goodbye to the 3 electric lights in the ceiling that seemed always, no matter where you sat, to cast the shadow of your head over the page you were writing on. And goodbye to their teacher, Miss Thorne, who had finished her last day of school speech, wishing them luck in the lives they were about to begin. Now, having run out of things to say, she was standing at her desk with her frayed shawl clasped around her shoulders. And still the mayor, the guest of honor, had not arrived. Someone's foot scraped back and forth on the floor. Miss Thorne sighed. Then the door rattled open and the mayor walked in. He looked annoyed, as though they were the ones who were late.
"Welcome, Mayor Cole," said Miss Thorne.
She held out her hand to him. The mayor made his mouth into a smile.
"Miss Thorne,"
he said, enfolding her hand.
"Greetings. Another year."
The mayor was a vast, heavy man, so big in the middle that his arms looked small and dangling. In one hand, he held a little cloth bag. He lumbered to the front of the room and faced the students. His gray, drooping face appeared to be made of something stiffer than ordinary skin. It rarely moved, except for making the smile that was on it now.
"Young people of the highest class," the mayor began.
He stopped and scanned the room for several moments. His eyes seemed to look out from far back inside his head. He nodded slowly.
Assignment day now, isn't it? Yes. First we get our education. Then we serve our city."
Again his eyes moved back and forth along the rows of students, and again he nodded, as if someone had confirmed what he'd said. He put the little bag on Miss Thorne's desk and rested his hand on it.
"What will that service be, eh? Perhaps you're wondering."
He did his smile again, and his heavy cheeks folded like drapes. Lina's hands were cold. She wrapped her cape around her and pressed her hands between her knees.
"Please hurry, Mr. Mayor," she said silently. "Please, just let us choose and get it over with."
Dune, in his mind, was saying the same thing, only he didn't say please.
Something to remember,
the mayor said, holding up one finger.
Job you draw today is for 3 years. Then, evaluation. Are you good at your job? Fine, you may keep it. Are you unsatisfactory? Is there a greater need elsewhere? You will be reassigned. It is extremely important,
he said, jabbing his finger at the class.
For all work of Ember to be done, to be properly done.
He picked up the bag and pulled open the drawstring.
So, let us begin. Simple procedure. Come up one at a time. Reach into this bag. Take one slip of paper. Read it out loud.
He smiled and nodded. The flesh under his chin bulged in and out.
Who cares to be first?
No one moved. Lina stared down at the top of her desk. There was a long silence. Then Lizzie Biscoe, one of Lina's best friends, sprang to her feet.
I would like to be first,
she said in her breathless, high voice.
Good. Walk forward.
Lizzie went to stand before the mayor. Because of her orange hair, she looked like a bright spark next to him.
Now, choose.
The mayor held out the bag with one hand and put the other behind his back, as if to show he would not interfere. Lizzie reached into the bag and withdrew a tightly folded square of paper. She unfolded it carefully. Lina couldn't see the look on Lizzie's face, but she could hear the disappointment in her voice as she read out loud,
Supply Depot Clerk.
Very good,
said the mayor.
A vital job.
Lizzie trudged back to her desk. Lina smiled at her, but Lizzie made a sour face. Supply Depot Clerk wasn't a bad job, but it was a dull one. The Supply Depot clerks sat behind a long counter, took orders from the storekeepers of Ember, and sent the carriers down to bring up what was wanted from the vast network of storerooms beneath Ember's streets. The storerooms held supplies of every kind, canned food, clothes, furniture, blankets, light bulbs, medicine, pots and pans, reams of paper, soap, more light bulbs, everything the people of Ember could possibly need. The clerks sat at their ledger books all day, recording the orders that came in and the goods that went out. Lizzie didn't like to sit still. She would have been better suited to something else, Lina thought. Messenger, maybe? The job Lina wanted for herself. Messengers ran through the city all day, going everywhere, seeing everything.
Next,
said the mayor. This time, two people stood up at once, Orly Gordon and Chet Nome. Orly quickly sat down again, and Chet approached the mayor.
Choose, young man,
the mayor said. Chet chose. He unfolded his scrap of paper.
Electrician's helper,
he read, and his wide face broke into a smile. Lina heard someone take a quick breath. She looked over to see Dune pressing a hand against his mouth. You never knew, each year, exactly which jobs would be offered. Some years there were several good jobs, like greenhouse helper, timekeeper's assistant or messenger, and no bad jobs at all. Other years, jobs like pipeworks laborer, trash sifter, and mold scraper were mixed in. But there would always be at least one or two jobs for electrician's helper. Fixing the electricity was the most important job in Ember, and more people worked at it than at anything else. Orly Gordon was next. She got the job of building repair assistant, which was a good job for Orly. She was a strong girl and liked hard work. Vindy Chance was made a greenhouse helper. She gave Lina a big grin as she went back to her seat. She'll get to work with Clary, Lina thought. Lucky. So far, no one had picked a really bad job. Perhaps this time, there would be no bad jobs at all. The idea gave her courage. Besides, she had reached the point where the suspense was giving her a stomach ache. So as Vindy sat down, even before the mayor could say next, she stood up and stepped forward. The little bag was made of faded green material, gathered at the top with a black string. Lina hesitated a moment, then put her hand inside and fingered the bits of paper. Feeling as if she were stepping off a high building, she picked one. She unfolded it. The words were written in black ink, in small, careful printing. "Pipe Works, laborer," they said. She stared at them.
"Out loud, please,"
the mayor said.
"Pipe Works, laborer,"
Lina said in a choked whisper.
"Louder," said the mayor.
"Pipe Works, laborer,"
Lina said again, her voice loud and cracked. There was a sigh of sympathy from the class. Keeping her eyes on the floor, Lina went back to her desk and sat down. Pipeworks laborers worked below the storerooms, in the deep labyrinth of tunnels that contained Ember's water and sewer pipes. They spent their days stopping up leaks and replacing pipe joints. It was wet, cold work. It could even be dangerous. A swift underground river ran through the pipeworks, and every now and then, someone fell into it and was lost. People were lost occasionally in the tunnels, too, if they strayed too far. Lina stared miserably down at a letter B someone had scratched into her desktop long ago. Almost anything would have been better than pipeworks laborer. Greenhouse helper had been her second choice. She imagined with longing the warm air and earthy smell of the greenhouse, where she could have worked with Clary, the greenhouse manager, someone she'd known all her life. She would have been content as a doctor's assistant, too, binding up cuts and bones. Even street sweeper or cart puller would have been better. At least then she could have stayed above ground, with space and people around her. She thought going down into the pipeworks must be like being buried alive. One by one, the other students chose their jobs. None of them got such a wretched job as hers. Finally, the last person rose from his chair and walked forward. It was Dune. His dark eyebrows were drawn together in a frown of concentration. His hands, Lina saw, were clenched into fists at his sides. Dune reached into the bag and took out the last scrap of paper. He paused a minute, pressing it tightly in his hand.
"Go on," said the mayor. "Read."
Unfolding the paper, Dune read,
"Messenger."
He scowled, crumpled the paper, and dashed it to the floor. Lina gasped. The whole class rustled in surprise. Why would anyone be angry to get the job of messenger?
"Bad behavior,"
cried the mayor. His eyes bulged and his face darkened.
"Go to your seat immediately."
Dune kicked the crumpled paper into a corner. Then he stalked back to his desk and flung himself down. The mayor took a short breath and blinked furiously.
"Disgraceful,"
he said, glaring at Dune.
"A childish display of temper. Students should be glad to work for their city. Ember will prosper if all citizens do their best."
He held up a stern finger as he said this, and moved his eyes slowly from one face to the next. Suddenly, Dune spoke up. "But Ember is not prospering," he cried. "Everything is getting worse and worse."
"Silence!"
cried the mayor. "The blackouts!" cried Dune. He jumped from his seat. "The lights go out all the time now, and the shortages of everything. If no one does anything about it, something terrible is going to happen." Lina listened with a pounding heart. What was wrong with Dune? Why was he so upset? He was taking things too seriously, as he always did. Miss Thorne strode to Dune and put a hand on his shoulder.
"Sit down now," she said quietly.
But Dune remained standing. The mayor glared. For a few moments he said nothing. Then he smiled, showing a neat row of gray teeth.
"Miss Thorne," he said, "who might this young man be?"
"I am Dune Harrow," said Dune.
"I will remember you," said the mayor.
He gave Dune a long look, then turned to the class and smiled his smile again.
"Congratulations to all," he said. "Welcome to Ember's workforce. Miss Thorne, class, thank you."
The mayor shook hands with Miss Thorne and departed. The students gathered their coats and caps and filed out of the classroom. Lina walked down the wide hallway with Lizzie, who said,
"Poor you! I thought I picked a bad one, but you got the worst. I feel lucky compared to you."
Once they were out the door, Lizzie said goodbye and scurried away, as if Lina's bad luck were a disease she might catch. Lina stood on the steps for a moment and gazed across Harkin Square, where people walked briskly, bundled up cozily in their coats and scarves, or talked to one another in the pools of light beneath the great street lamps. A boy in a red messenger's jacket ran toward the gathering hall. On Otterwill Street, a man pulled a cart filled with sacks of potatoes. And in the buildings all around the square, rows of lighted windows shone bright yellow and deep gold. Lina sighed. This was where she wanted to be. Up here where everything happened, not down underground. Someone tapped her on the shoulder. Startled, she turned and saw Dune behind her. His thin face looked pale.
"Will you trade with me?"
he asked.
"Trade? Trade jobs? I don't want to waste my time being a messenger. I want to help save the city, not run around carrying gossip."
Lina gaped at him.
"You'd rather be in the pipeworks?"
"Electrician's helper is what I wanted," Dune said. "But Chet won't trade, of course. Pipeworks is second best."
"But why?"
"Because the generator is in the pipeworks," said Dune.
Lina knew about the generator, of course. In some mysterious way, it turned the running of the river into power for the city. You could feel its deep rumble when you stood in Plummer Square.
"I need to see the generator," Dune said. I have ideas about it."
He thrust his hands into his pockets.
"So?"
he said.
"Will you trade?"
"Yes," cried Lina. "Messenger is the job I want most."
And not a useless job at all, in her opinion. People couldn't be expected to trudge halfway across the city every time they wanted to communicate with someone. Messengers connected everyone to everyone else. Anyway, whether it was important or not, the job of messenger just happened to be perfect for Lina. She loved to run. She could run forever. And she loved exploring every nook and cranny of the city, which was what a messenger got to do.
"All right, then," said Dune.
He handed her his crumpled piece of paper, which he must have retrieved from the floor. Lina reached into her pocket, pulled out her slip of paper, and handed it to him.
"Thank you," he said.
"You're welcome," said Lina.
Happiness sprang up in her, and happiness always made her want to run. She took the steps three at a time and sped down Broad Street toward home. Chapter 2. A Message to the Mayor. Lina often took different routes between school and home. Sometimes, just for variety, she'd go all the way around Sparkswallow Square, or way up by the shoe repair shops on Livery Street. But today, she took the shortest route because she was eager to get home and tell her news. She ran fast and easily through the streets of Ember. Every corner, every alley, every building was familiar to her. She always knew where she was, though most streets looked more or less the same. All of them were lined with old two-story stone buildings, the wood of their window frames and doors long unpainted. On the street level were shops. Above the shops were the apartments where people lived. Every building, at the place where the wall met the roof, was equipped with a row of floodlights, big cone-shaped lamps that cast a strong yellow glare. Stone walls, lighted windows, lumpy, muffled shapes of people, Lina flew by them. Her slender legs felt immensely strong, like the wood of a bow that flexes and springs. She darted around obstacles, broken furniture left for the trash heaps or for scavengers, stoves and refrigerators that were past repair, peddlers sitting on the pavement with their wares spread out around them. She leapt over cracks and potholes. When she came to Hafter Street, she slowed a little. This street was deep in shadow. Four of its street lamps were out and had not been fixed. For a second, Lina thought of the rumor she'd heard about light bulbs, that some kinds were completely gone. She was used to shortages of things. Everyone was. But not of light bulbs. If the bulbs for the street lamps ran out, the only lights would be inside the buildings. What would happen then? How could people find their way through the streets in the dark? Somewhere inside her, a black worm of dread stirred. She thought about Dune's outburst in class. Could things really be as bad as he said? She didn't want to believe it. She pushed the thought away. As she turned onto Budlow Street, she sped up again. She passed a line of customers waiting to get into the vegetable market, their shopping bags draped over their arms. At the corner of Oliver Street, she dodged a group of washers trudging along with bags of laundry and some movers carrying away a broken table. She passed a street sweeper shoving dust around with his broom.
"I am so lucky," she thought, "to have the job I want. And because of Dune Harrow, of all people."
When they were younger, Lina and Dune had been friends. Together they had explored the back alleys and dimly lit edges of the city. But in their fourth year of school, they had begun to grow apart. It started one day during the hour of free time, when the children in their class were playing on the front steps of the school.
"I can go down three steps at a time," someone would boast. "I can hop down on one foot," someone else would say.
The others would chime in.
"I can do a handstand against the pillar. I can leapfrog over the trash can."
As soon as one child did something, all the rest would do it too, to prove they could. Lina could do it all, even when the dares got wilder. She yelled out the wildest one of all.
"I can climb the light pole."
For a second, everyone just stared at her. But Lina dashed across the street, took off her shoes and socks, and wrapped herself around the cold metal of the pole. Pushing with her bare feet, she inched upward. She didn't get very far before she lost her grip and fell back down. The children laughed, and so did she.
"I didn't say I'd climb to the top," she explained. "I just said I'd climb it."
The others swarmed forward to try. Lizzie wouldn't take off her socks. Her feet were too cold, she said, so she kept sliding back. 40 Pen wasn't strong enough to get more than a foot off the ground. Next came Dune. He took his shoes and socks off and placed them neatly at the foot of the pole. Then he announced in his serious way, "I'm going to the top." He clasped the pole and started upward, pushing with his feet, his knees sticking out to the sides. He pulled himself upward, pushed again. He was higher now than Lina had been. But suddenly, his hands slid and he came plummeting down. He landed on his bottom, with his legs poking up in the air. Lina laughed. She shouldn't have. He might have been hurt. But he looked so funny that she couldn't help it. He wasn't hurt. He could have jumped up, grinned, and walked away. But Dune didn't take things lightly. When he heard Lina and the others laughing, his face darkened. His temper rose in him like hot water.
"Don't you dare laugh at me," he said to Lina.
I did better than you did. That was a stupid idea anyway. Stupid, stupid idea to climb that pole.
And as he was shouting, red in the face, their teacher, Mrs. Polster, came out onto the steps and saw him. She took him by the shirt collar to the school director's office, where he got a scolding he didn't think he deserved. After that day, Lina and Dune barely looked at each other when they passed in the hallway. At first, it was because they were fuming about what had happened. Dune didn't like being laughed at. Lina didn't like being shouted at. After a while, the memory of the light pole incident faded, but by then, they had got out of the habit of friendship. By the time they were 12, they knew each other only as classmates. Lina was friends with Vindy Chance, Orly Gordon, and most of all, red-haired Lizzie Biscoe, who could run almost as fast as Lina and could talk 3 times faster. Now, as Lina sped toward home, she felt immensely grateful to Dune and hoped he'd come to no harm in the pipeworks. Maybe they'd be friends again. She'd like to ask him about the pipeworks. She was curious about it. When she got to Greystone Street, she passed Clary Lane, who was probably on her way to the greenhouses. Clary waved to her and called out, "What job?" And Lina called back, "Messenger," and ran on. Lina lived in Quilliam Square, over the yarn shop run by her grandmother. When she got to the shop, she burst in the door and cried,
"Granny, I'm a messenger!"
Granny's shop had once been a tidy place, where each ball of yarn and spool of thread had its spot in the cubbyholes that lined the walls. All the yarn and thread came from old clothes that had gotten too shabby to be worn. Granny unraveled sweaters and picked apart dresses and jackets and pants. She wound the yarn into balls and the thread onto spools, and people bought them to use in making new clothes. These days, the shop was a mess. Long loops and strands of yarn dangled out of the cubbyholes, and the browns and grays and purples were mixed in with the ochres and olive greens and dark blues. Granny's customers often had to spend half an hour unsnarling the rust-red yarn from the mud brown, or trying to fish out the end of a thread from a tangled wad. Granny wasn't much help. Most days she just dozed behind the counter in her rocking chair. That's where she was when Lina burst in with her news. Lina saw that Granny had forgotten to knot up her hair that morning. It was standing out from her head in a wild white frizz. Granny stood up, looking puzzled.
"You aren't a messenger, dear. You're a schoolgirl," she said. "But, Granny, today was assignment day. I got my job, and I'm a messenger."
Granny's eyes lit up, and she slapped her hand down on the counter.
"I remember," she cried. "Messenger, that's a grand job. You'll be good at it."
Lina's little sister toddled out from behind the counter on unsteady legs. She had a round face and round brown eyes. At the top of her head was a sprig of brown hair tied up with a scrap of red yarn. She grabbed on to Lina's knees.
"Lina, Lina,"
she said. Lina bent over and took the child's hands.
"Poppy, your big sister got a good job. Are you happy, Poppy? Are you proud of me?"
Poppy said something that sounded like,
"Happy, happy, happy."
Lina laughed, hoisted her up, and danced with her around the shop. Lina loved her little sister so much that it was like an ache under her ribs. The baby and Granny were all the family she had now. 2 years ago, when the coughing sickness was raging through the city again, her father had died. Some months later, her mother, giving birth to Poppy, had died too. Lina missed her parents with an ache that was as strong as what she felt for Poppy, only it was a hollow feeling instead of a full one.
"When do you start?" asked Granny.
"Tomorrow," said Lina. "I report to the messenger station at 8 o'clock.
"You'll be a famous messenger," said Granny. "Fast,
corrupt and famous.
Taking Poppy with her, Lina went out of the shop and climbed the stairs to their apartment. It was a small apartment, only 4 rooms, but there was enough stuff in it to fill 20. There were things that had belonged to Lina's parents, her grandparents, and even their grandparents. Old, broken, cracked, threadbare things that had been patched and repaired dozens or hundreds of times. People in Ember rarely threw anything away. They made the best possible use of what they had. In Lina's apartment, layers of worn rugs and carpets covered the floor, making it soft but uneven underfoot. Against one wall squatted a sagging couch with round wooden balls for legs, and on the couch were blankets and pillows, so many that you had to toss some on the floor before you could sit down. Against the opposite wall stood 2 wobbly tables that held a clutter of plates and bottles, cups and bowls, unmatching forks and spoons, little piles of scrap paper, bits of string wound up in untidy wads, and a few stubby pencils. There were 4 lamps, 2 tall ones that stood on the floor, and 2 short ones that stood on tables. And in uneven lines, up near the ceiling, were hooks that held coats and shawls and nightgowns and sweaters, shelves that held pots and pans, jars with unreadable labels, and boxes of buttons and pins and tacks. Where there were no shelves, the walls had been decorated with things of beauty. A label from a can of peaches, a few dried yellow squash flowers, a strip of faded but still pretty purple cloth. There were drawings, too. Lina had done the drawings out of her imagination. They showed a city that looked somewhat like Ember, except that its buildings were lighter and taller, and had more windows. One of the drawings had fallen to the floor. Lina retrieved it and pinned it back up. She stood for a minute and looked at the pictures. Over and over, she'd drawn the same city. Sometimes she drew it as seen from afar. Sometimes she chose one of its buildings and drew it in detail. She put in stairways and street lamps and carts. Sometimes she tried to draw the people who lived in the city, though she wasn't good at drawing people. Their heads always came out too small, and their hands looked like spiders. One picture showed a scene in which the people of the city greeted her when she arrived, the first person they had ever seen to come from elsewhere. They argued with each other about who should be the first to invite her home. Lina could see this city so clearly in her mind, she almost believed it was real. She knew it couldn't be, though. The book of the City of Ember, which all children studied in school, taught otherwise. The City of Ember was made for us long ago by the Builders, the book said. It is the only light in the dark world. Beyond Ember, the darkness goes on forever in all directions. Lina had been to the outer border of Ember. She had stood at the edge of the trash heaps and gazed into the darkness beyond the city, the unknown regions. No one had ever gone far into the unknown regions, or at least no one had gone far and returned. And no one had ever arrived in Ember from the unknown regions either. As far as anyone knew, the darkness did go on forever. Still, Lina wanted the other city to exist. In her imagination, it was so beautiful, and it seemed so real. Sometimes she longed to go there and take everyone in Ember with her. But she wasn't thinking about the other city now. Today, she was happy to be right where she was. She set Poppy on the couch.
"Wait there," she said.
She went into the kitchen where there was an electric stove and a refrigerator that no longer worked and was used to store glasses and dishes so Poppy couldn't get at them. Above the refrigerator were shelves holding more pots and jars, more spoons and knives, a wind-up clock that Granny always forgot to wind, and a long row of cans. Lina tried to keep the cans in alphabetical order so she could find what she wanted quickly, but Granny always messed them up. Now she saw there were beans at the end of the row and tomatoes at the beginning.
She picked out a can labeled baby drink and a jar of boiled carrots, opened them, poured the liquid into a cup and the carrots into a little dish, and took these back to the baby on the couch. Poppy dribbled baby drink down her chin. She ate some of her carrots and poked others between the couch cushions. For the moment, Lina felt almost perfectly happy. There was no need to think about the fate of the city right now.
Tomorrow, she'd be a messenger.
She wiped the orange goop off Poppy's chin.
"Don't worry," she said. "Everything will be all right."
The messenger's headquarters was on Cloving Street, not far from the back of the gathering hall. When Lina arrived the next morning, she was greeted by messenger captain Alice Fleary, a bony woman with pale eyes and hair the color of dust.
"Our new girl,"
said Captain Fleary to the other messengers, a cluster of 9 people who smiled and nodded at Lina.
"I have your jacket right here,"
said the captain. She handed Lina a red jacket like the one all messengers wore. It was only a little too large. From the clock tower of the gathering hall came a deep, reverberating bong.
8 o'clock,
cried Captain Fleary. She waved a long arm.
Take your stations.
As the clock sounded 7 more times, the messengers scattered in all directions. The captain turned to Lina.
Your station,
she said,
is Garn Square.
Lina nodded and started off, but the captain caught her by the collar.
I haven't told you the rules,
she said. She held up a knobby finger.
1, when a customer gives you a message, repeat it back to make sure you have it right. 2, always wear your red jacket so people can identify you. 3, go as fast as possible. Your customers pay 20 cents for every message, no matter how far you have to take it.
Lina nodded.
I always go fast, she said.
4, the captain went on. Deliver a message only to the person it's meant for, no one else.
Lina nodded again. She bounced a little on her toes, eager to get going. Captain Fleary smiled.
Go,
she said, and Lina was off. She felt strong and speedy and sure-footed. She glanced at her reflection as she ran past the window of a furniture repair shop. She liked the look of her long dark hair flying out behind her, her long legs in their black socks, and her flapping red jacket. Her face, which had never seemed especially remarkable, looked almost beautiful, because she looked so happy. As soon as she came into Garn Square, a voice cried,
"Messenger!"
Her first customer. It was old Natty Prine, calling to her from the bench where he always sat.
"This goes to Ravenette Parsons, 18 Silverton Square," he said. "Bend down."
She bent down so that her ear was close to his whiskery mouth. The old man said in a slow, hoarse voice,
"My stove is broke. Don't come for dinner. Repeat."
Lina repeated the message.
"Good,"
said Natty Prine. He gave Lina 20 cents, and she ran across the city to Silverton Square. There she found Ravenette Parsons also sitting on a bench. She recited the message to him.
"Old turnip head," he growled. "Lazy old fooly face. He just doesn't feel like cooking." No reply.
Lina ran back to Garn Square, passing a group of believers on the way. They were standing in a circle holding hands, singing one of their cheerful songs. It seemed to Lina there were more believers than ever these days. What they believed in, she didn't know, but it must make them happy. They were always smiling. Her next customer turned out to be Mrs. Polster, the teacher of the 4th-year class. In Mrs. Polster's class, they memorized passages from the Book of the City of Ember every week. Mrs. Polster had charts on the walls for everything, with everyone's name listed. If you did something right, she made a green dot by your name. If you did something wrong, she made a red dot.
"What you need to learn, children,"
she always said in her resonant, precise voice, is the difference between right and wrong in every area of life. And once you learn the difference... Here she would stop and point to the class, and the class would finish the sentence. You must always choose the right. In every situation, Mrs. Polster knew what the right choice was. Now here was Mrs. Polster again, looming over Lina and pronouncing her message.
To Anisette Lefrande, 39 Hum Street, as follows, she said. My confidence in you has been seriously diminished since I heard about the disreputable activities in which you engaged on Thursday last. Please repeat.
It took Lina 3 tries to get this right.
Uh-oh, a red dot for me, she said.
Mrs. Polster did not seem to find this amusing. Lina had 19 customers that first morning. Some of them had ordinary messages. I can't come on Tuesday. Buy a pound of potatoes on your way home. Please come and fix my front door. Others had messages that made no sense to her at all, like Mrs. Polster's. But it didn't matter. The wonderful part about being a messenger was not the messages, but the places she got to go. She could go into the houses of people she didn't know, and hidden alleyways and little rooms in the backs of stores. In just a few hours, she discovered all kinds of strange and interesting things. For instance, Mrs. Sample, the mender, had to sleep on her couch because her entire bedroom, almost up to the ceiling, was crammed with clothes to be mended. Dr. Felinia Tower had the skeleton of a person hanging against her living room wall, its bones all held in place with black strings.
I study it, she said when she saw Lina staring. I have to know how people are put together.
At a house on Kalu Street, Lina delivered a message to a worried-looking man whose living room was completely dark.
I'm saving on light bulbs, the man said.
And when Lina took a message to the Cannes Café, she learned that on certain days the back room was used as a meeting place for people who liked to converse about great subjects.
Do you think an invisible being is watching over us all the time?
She heard someone ask.
Perhaps,
answered someone else. There was a long silence.
And then again, perhaps not.
All of it was interesting. She loved finding things out, and she loved running. And even by the end of the day, she wasn't tired. Running made her feel strong and big-hearted. It made her love the places she ran through and the people whose messages she delivered. She wished she could bring all of them the good news they so desperately wanted to hear. Late in the afternoon, a young man came up to her, walking with a sort of sideways lurch. He was an odd-looking person. He had a very long neck, with a bump in the middle, and teeth so big they looked as if they were trying to escape from his mouth. His black, bushy hair stuck out from his head in untidy tufts.
I have a message for the mayor at the gathering hall, he said.
He paused to let the importance of this be understood.
The mayor, he said. Did you get that?
I got it, said Lina.
All right. Listen carefully. Tell him delivery at 8 from Looper. Repeat it back.
Delivery at 8 from Looper,
Lina repeated. It was an easy message.
All right. No answer required.
He handed her 20 cents, and she sprinted away. The gathering hall occupied one entire side of Harkin Square, which was the city's central plaza. The square was paved with stone. It had a few benches bolted to the ground here and there, as well as a couple of kiosks for notices. Wide steps led up to the gathering hall, and fat columns framed its big door. The mayor's office was in the gathering hall.
So were the offices of the clerks, who kept track of which buildings had broken windows, what street lamps needed repair, and the number of people in the city. There was the office of the timekeeper, who was in charge of the town clock. And there were offices for the guards who enforced the laws of Ember, now and then putting pickpockets or people who got in fights into the prison room, a small one-story structure with a sloping roof that jutted out from one side of the building. Lina ran up the steps and through the door into a broad hallway. On the left was a desk, and at the desk sat a guard. "Barton Snowd, assistant guard," said a badge on his chest. He was a big man, with wide shoulders, brawny arms, and a thick neck. But his head looked as if it didn't belong to his body. It was small and round, and topped with a fuzz of extremely short hair. His lower jaw jutted out, and moved a little from side to side, as if he were chewing on something. When he saw Lina, his jaw stopped moving for a moment, and his lips curled upward in a very small smile.
"Good day," he said. "What business brings you here today?"
"I have a message for the mayor."
"Very good, very good."
Barton Snowd heaved himself to his feet.
"Step this way."
He led Lina down the corridor and opened a door marked Reception Room.
"Wait here, please," he said. "The mayor is in his basement office on private business, but he will be up shortly."
Lina went inside.
"I'll notify the mayor,"
said Barton Snowd.
"Please, have a seat. The mayor will be right with you. Or pretty soon."
He left, closing the door behind him. A second later, the door opened again, and the guard's small, fuzzy head reappeared.
"What is the message?"
he asked.
"I have to give it to the mayor in person," said Lina.
Of course,"
said the guard. The door closed again.
"He doesn't seem very sure about things," Lina thought. "Maybe he's new at his job."
The reception room was shabby, but Lina could tell that it had once been impressive. The walls were dark red, with brownish patches where the paint was peeling away. In the right-hand wall was a closed door. An ugly brown carpet lay on the floor, and on it stood a large armchair covered in itchy-looking red material, and several smaller chairs. A small table held a teapot and some cups, and a larger table in the middle of the room displayed a copy of the Book of the City of Ember, lying open as if someone were going to read from it. Portraits of all the mayors of the city since the beginning of time hung on the walls, staring solemnly from behind pieces of old window glass. Lina sat in the big armchair and waited. No one came. She got up and wandered around the room. She bent over the Book of the City of Ember and read a few sentences. "The citizens of Ember may not have luxuries, but the foresight of the builders, who filled the storerooms at the beginning of time, has ensured that they will always have enough, and enough is all that a person of wisdom needs." She flipped a few pages. "The gathering hall clock," she read, "measures the hours of night and day. It must never be allowed to run down. Without it, how would we know when to go to work and when to go to school? How would the light director know when to turn the lights on and when to turn them off again? It is the job of the timekeeper to wind the clock every week and to place the date sign in Harkin Square every day. The timekeeper must perform these duties faithfully." Lina knew that not all timekeepers were as faithful as they should be. She'd heard of one, some years ago, who often forgot to change the date sign, so that it might say, "Wednesday, week 38, year 227, for several days in a row. There had even been timekeepers who forgot to wind the clock, so that it might stand at noon or at midnight for hours at a time, causing a very long day or a very long night.
The result was that no one really knew any more exactly what day of the week it was, or exactly how many years it had been since the building of the city. They called this the year 241, but it might have been 245, or 239, or 250. As long as the clock's deep boom rang out every hour, and the lights went on and off more or less regularly, it didn't seem to matter. Lina left the book and examined the pictures of the mayors. The seventh mayor, Pod Morthwart, was her great—she didn't know how many greats—grandfather. He looked quite dreary, Lina thought. His cheeks were long and hollow, his mouth turned down at the corners, and there was a lost look in his eyes. The picture she liked best was of the fourth mayor, Jane Larkett, who had a serene smile and fuzzy black hair. Still no one came. She heard no sounds from the hallway. Maybe they'd forgotten her. Lina went over to the closed door in the right-hand wall. She pulled it open and saw stairs going up. Maybe, while she waited, she'd just see where they went. She started upward. At the top of the first flight was a closed door. Carefully, she opened it. She saw another hallway and more closed doors. She shut the door and kept going. Her footsteps sounded loud on the wood, and she was afraid someone would hear her and come and scold her. No doubt she was not supposed to be here. But no one came, and she climbed on, passing another closed door. The gathering hall was the only building in Ember with three stories. She had always wanted to stand on its roof and look out at the city. Maybe from there it would be possible to see beyond the city, into the unknown regions. If the bright city of her drawings really did exist, it would be out there somewhere. At the top of the stairs, she came to a door marked Roof, and she pushed it open. Chilly air brushed against her skin. She was outside. Ahead of her was a flat gravel surface, and about 10 paces away, she could see the high wall of the clock tower. She went to the edge of the roof. From there, she could see the whole of Ember. Directly below was Harkin Square, where people were moving this way and that, all of them appearing, from this top-down view, more round than tall. Beyond Harkin Square, the lighted windows of the buildings made checkered lines, yellow and black, row after row, in all directions. She tried to see farther, across the unknown regions, but she couldn't. At the edges of the city, the lights were so far away that they made a kind of haze. She could see nothing beyond them but blackness. She heard a shout from the square below. "Look!" came a small but piercing voice. "Someone on the roof!" She saw a few people stop and look up. "Who is it? What's she doing up there?" someone cried. More people gathered until a crowd was standing on the steps of the gathering hall. "They see me," Lina thought, and it made her laugh. She waved at the crowd and did a few steps from the Bugfoot Scurry Dance, which she'd learned on Cloving Square Dance Day, and they laughed and shouted some more. Then the door behind her burst open, and a huge guard with a bushy black beard was suddenly running toward her. "Halt!" he shouted, though she wasn't going anywhere. He grabbed her by the arm. "What are you doing here?"
"I was just curious," said Lina, in her most innocent voice. "I wanted to see the city from the roof."
She read the guard's name badge. It said, "Reg Stabmark, Chief Guard."
"Curiosity leads to trouble," said Reg Stabmark.
He peered down at the crowd.
"You have caused a commotion."
He pulled her toward the door and hustled her down all three flights of stairs. When they came out into the waiting room, Barton Snowd was standing there looking flustered, his jaw twitching from side to side. Next to him was the mayor.
"A child causing trouble, Mayor Cole," said the chief guard.
The mayor glared at her.
"I recall your face from assignment day. Shame. Disgracing yourself in your new job."
"I didn't mean to cause trouble," said Lina. I was looking for you so I could deliver a message.
Shall we put her in the prison room for a day or two?
Asked the chief guard. The mayor frowned. He pondered a moment.
What is the message?
He said. He bent down so that Lina could speak into his ear. She noticed that he smelled a little like overcooked turnips.
Delivery at 8, Lina whispered. From Looper.
The mayor smiled a tight little smile. He turned to the guard.
Just a child's antics,
he said.
We will let it go this time. From now on,
he said to Lina.
Behave yourself.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, said Lina.
And you,
said the mayor, turning to the assistant guard and shaking a thick finger at him.
Watch visitors much more carefully.
Barton Snowd blinked and nodded. Lina ran for the door. Outside, the small crowd was still standing by the steps. A few of them cheered as Lina came out. Others frowned at her and muttered words like mischief and silliness and show off. Lina felt embarrassed suddenly. She hadn't meant to show off. She hurried past, out into Otterwill Street, and started to run. She didn't see Dune, who was among those watching her. He had been on his way home from his first day in the pipeworks when he'd come across the cluster of people gazing up at the roof of the gathering hall and laughing. He was tired and chilly. The bottoms of his pants legs were wet, and mud clung to his shoes and smeared his hands. When he raised his eyes and saw the small figure next to the clock tower, he realized right away that it was Lina. He saw her raise her arm and wave and hop about, and for a second, he wondered what it would be like to be up there, looking out over the whole city, laughing and waving. When Lina came down, he wanted to speak to her, but he knew he was filthy-looking, and that she would ask him questions he didn't want to answer. So he turned away. Walking fast, he headed for home.